Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. My name is Denny Griffin, and for the next half hour, I'll be your host on the program Las Vegas and the Mob. And tonight I'm going to have two guests who know a lot about Las Vegas and the Mob. And the first one has just called in now, and I'll put him on the line with us. Hello, Louie.
Yes.
Yeah, how you doing tonight?
Good, good.
Okay.
Happy I got through.
We're on the air right now. Hold on just a second. I have our other guest on the line, and I'll introduce you guys. Well, while we're making contact here, hello, is this Frank?
Yeah.
Frank, hold on. I'm going to introduce you and Louie. He's on the line with us.
All right.
My two guests tonight are a former Chicago Outfit associate and one of the key players in Las Vegas. He worked with Tony Spilotro here, and his name is Frank Collada. Frank, welcome to Las Vegas and the Mob.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us is retired Las Vegas Metro Police Detective, Louis D. Tiberius. Louis.
Yes.
Welcome.
Thank you. Hi, Frank.
How you doing, Louis?
Okay, and for background, folks, here's the scoop. During the late 1970s and early 1980s, Frank came to town from Chicago. He had been a childhood friend of Tony Spilotro's. And for any of you who have seen the movie Casino, Frank Vincent played an assistant or a close friend and confidant to Joe Pesci. Pesci's character was based on Spilotro, and Frank Vincent's character of Frankie was based on Frank Collada. And Frank was a technical advisor to the movie, technical consultant, and but in real life, that time frame in Vegas, 79 through 82, when Frank was here working with Tony, Louis D. Tiberius was one of the Metro detectives who was in hot pursuit of these guys. And we're going to talk a little bit tonight about what it was really like in Vegas at that time. Frank, let me start with you. The time frame we're talking about, 79 through 82, now you came in from Chicago. Tony had invited you, well, he invited you a few times to come here, and finally in 79 you accepted his offer. And when you got to town, you met with Tony to find out what it was he wanted you to do. Could you tell us what it was that Tony expected and wanted you to do for him?
Well, I was to watch his back so nobody would try to kill him or muscle him. And he also wanted me to bring in a crew of guys to assist me. Plus, part of our function was going to be to muscle bookmakers that were booking, doing illegal book, not to the casinos, and he wanted to book into them or get a piece of their action. And I also told him at that time that my guys had to earn. And he says, no problem. And then he told me what they could do. And I asked him at that time, aren't we going against the outfit rules by robbing out here? And he says, I got an okay. Everything's going to be all right.
Okay, so as far as you go, we're all on board with this deal. And your guys were going to do stuff that Tony needed to have done, plus they could operate independently to earn a living when they weren't involved with Tony.
I had no reason to not believe him because he was a made man, and I figured there was no problem. I knew who his superiors were, and so I done what he said, what he asked me to do.
And the crew you put together eventually became known as the Hole in the Wall Gang, am I right?
Yes.
Okay. And the Hole in the Wall Gang came, the handle you guys got was because of entering businesses or residences that you were going to burglarize by going through the wall, cutting a hole in the wall, and then going through that way, bypassing alarmed doors and windows?
Yes, at that time, the alarm systems weren't as elaborate as they are nowadays. And most of the places that we went in, they didn't have motion detectors. So instead of shutting off the alarms in front of the house, we always made entry through the back through a hole. We made a hole in the wall and went in. And then we sort of like, if people are going to have pads on the floor that would trigger an alarm, we would make sure that we jump from one room to the other without walking on any carpets where the pads would be. And that's how we made our entry. And then eventually, through the notoriety of the newspaper about the holes that we were making the walls, other thieves that were out there were doing the same thing, copycats. So we became known as the hole-in-the-wall gang.
Okay, and Louis, now you moved to Vegas from New York City in 76, right? You had been working for the NYPD there, and then you came and took a job with Metro here?
Yes, that's correct.
And you were working, when Frank got to town in 79, where were you assigned at that time in Metro?
I was up in the Intelligence Bureau, and at that time it was a big combination. It was really an information gathering unit, but we were inclusive with Vice Narcotics Intelligence, and we did a lot of things.
And 79, that would have been just the time that a new sheriff had taken over in January, a guy by the name of John McCarthy. So you were working for him at that point?
Yeah, I was doing narcotics, and I really got involved with organized crime through the unions. Part of the Intelligence Bureau, one of the other detectives, was working union stuff, and I was pretty new up there. So with my accent and the new face, I was doing a lot of undercover work. And I really got involved with the Culinary Union, and that's how I got to meet some of the organized crime guys.
Now, you didn't know Frank prior to this, right? I mean, he was from Chicago, you were from New York, so you two would never cross paths before.
No. I grew up in a neighborhood in New York, and all my organized crime knowledge was based on being a kid in New York from all the Goombas that lived there. I didn't know anybody about Chicago. But then our sheriff, our commander, and they put a team together, and we started working with the FBI. And they knew all about Tony, and they knew about Chicago in Vegas, and that became a priority up in intelligence.
Now, right prior to that, in 78, under a different sheriff, Metro got a little bit of a black eye, didn't it? There was a couple of detectives. One of them was named Joe Blasco, who'd been caught on FBI wiretaps passing information to the mobsters.
Yeah, that was another indication why Metro really started looking at Chicago. That happened just before I went up there. Excuse me. And it was pretty hot up there when I got up there because of that. There was a lot of old-timers that knew this detective and were pretty shocked, and a lot of us new guys didn't fall right into the normal game. So that's why they used us to go after the old Chicago people.
Now, one of the things Sheriff McCarthy, or I guess when he was candidate McCarthy in 78 prior to the election, he ran as a reform candidate, and one of the things he did, he vowed to clean up Metro, and after the Blasco scandal, and also declare war on organized crime, and apparently he followed through on his promises, huh?
Yeah, he sure did. One of the big things with him was, and especially within Metro, is everybody felt that they were pretty much in shock that this guy made a sheriff. He was no administrator and no politician. But what he was, and the reason everything worked out so well, is that he was a cop. And he put together a team. I shouldn't say he actually put together a team, but he let the teams that were in place do their job. And because of that, we actually worked hand in hand with the FBI and was able to really do something.
So you, when I say you, I mean Metro and the FBI then combined to go after the Spilotro operation, which at that point now included Frank, because he was now on the scene. Frank, when you got in town and started in, did you know the kind of heat that was already on or was coming? Did you know how bad the Metro and the FBI were looking to get rid of Tony? I mean, get him out of business.
Well, yeah, according to the newspapers and what Tony was saying, telling me that he had a lot of heat on him and they were bugging his place and stuff like that. So we knew that I knew that he had a lot of heat on him, and mostly I tried to stay away from him. In other words, I didn't make frequent visits to his house. But when I opened up a restaurant, that's when I guess everybody seen the lock between him and I, because he started coming by the restaurant on a frequently basis, and my restaurant was being watched by Metro and the FBI at the time.
Now, your restaurant,
put two and two together, and that's the way I got into this picture.
Your restaurant was called the Upper Crust, right?
That's correct.
And you had a partner there, a guy by the name of Leo Guardino?
Yeah, Leo was, I would say, my second in command at that time. He was, how would you call it? He was obsessed with stealing. He loved to steal. Go ahead. I'm going to go in the other room.
He was then part of the hole in the wall gang. In fact, he was one of the first members.
Well, he was the first one. Yeah, him and I were the first ones, and then we recruited everybody else after that.
And it was kind of funny. I thought that when you bought the Upper Crust, you and Leo, you got it from the proceeds of your first three burglaries in Vegas together.
Two or three, yeah. I think it took about $60,000, and we did that in there. I think the first couple of houses, robbing maitre d's and stuff like that, they all kept cash in their homes.
So you guys invested the money back in the community by opening the business.
Well, we had good intentions of going legit after that. Well, semi-legit, you know.
Yeah.
But Metro was on us along with the FBI, and we had to continue robbing in order to pay all our lawyers' fees.
All the overhead.
All the overhead, which was very large.
Louis, now, from Metro's perspective, you guys came up after John McCarthy got in office and reorganized, put a new commander in charge of Intel, and some new personnel were brought in. You guys come up with a strategy of how to go after Tony and Frank and their associates. Could you tell us a little bit about how you guys approached them and what your thoughts were, how you would get them?
Well, we started out pretty, with that big ego trip. I was working undercover, and my squad was really assigned to the Chicago mob. So when we first started, we were going out, meeting people, working undercover, going into places, and getting absolutely nowhere. Then we got a new sergeant up there called Gene Smith. And when he came up, boy, he redid everything. Instead of being covert, he made us all go overt and said, we're going to just go after the mob. And that was the new picture. And if it wasn't for him, we'd probably still be, hitting and missing. But we went over. We started living with these people. We made lists. Eventually, we came up with really looking at Tony Spilotro's people, and we did some probability factor stuff and came up with the one of the key guys was Frank Collada, and we really started targeting on Frank because we knew if we can get to him somehow, everybody below him would fall, and it would be a big problem for anybody above him.
So Frank turned out to be the key man based on your studies and the strategy that was developed after you decided to go overt with this thing.
Right. Frank was in a position to, to really get us noticed, and we stuck with him.
24 hours a day.
Yeah.
I should have moved him in.
Playing him as a dependent, right?
See, we did all the groundwork. The FBI gave us the information, but we did all the groundwork. And typical FBI, then, after we put something together, they would come in. But it was the thing that was really, really good is that it's not that often that local law enforcement would work hand-in-hand with the FBI. There's a lot of mistrust and a lot of egos. That
a lot of jealousy.
Yeah, a lot of jealousy. But in this incident, I'll tell you what, we really, really worked together.
Hold on.
It paid off.
Fellas, we got a caller on the line here. Let's see if we have a question. Switch towards Logie tonight here. A caller from 605, area code, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. I was just wondering what kind of correlation there is between, at that era of organized crime and what goes on now in Las Vegas, if there's any correlation at all.
Okay, very good. Frank and Louie, would you care to take that? The question
is... Let Louie take it.
Okay, Louie,
well,
go ahead.
The correlation I see is that for lack of a better word, the criminal element is out of Las Vegas in the status that they were at that time, but the corporations came in. So for the community and for Las Vegas, it had it up and its downs. The criminal element was gone, but the big corporations really turned things around. Because way back in the old days, I remember people used to say that Vegas was mobster friendly, but nowadays they call it corporate cold. And Vegas has lost a lot of its limelight.
Charm.
Would you say,
well,
though...
Well put, Louie.
Would you guys say, though, that there's still probably organized crime here, but just in a different form? In other words, like Louie was saying, they're out of the hidden ownership and control of the casinos because of the corporations, but there's... you think they might still be here organized crime?
Well, let me answer that a little bit.
Sure.
When you say organized crime, this means a group of people that are a group of individuals that work with each other. I don't think, and the magnitude that we were at that time, that exists any longer. I'm sure there's criminals out there, but I don't think there's anything organized as far as the outfit goes.
Okay, so they're pretty much part of history now instead of still being active.
That's my belief.
Did that answer your question, caller?
It did, yes. Thank
okay,
you.
And thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it.
You bet.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about a couple of things. Now, Louie, when you guys decided to go overt and put the pressure on, if you will, did you have any special techniques you would use? I understand that you wanted Frank and Tony and these guys to know they were being watched. And Frank spent a lot of time at the Upper Crust because it was his business and it was kind of a hot spot. And you guys, Metro and the FBI, spent a lot of time there too, didn't you? At least outside the place.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Whenever we could. I mean, being in that kind of a unit, you're not working 24/7 just on Chicago. I mean, there's a lot of other things you have to do within that unit, but every chance you had, you went out there and you made your presence known. And Frank could probably vouch for this, that how many times he just looked out his window or came out and was, flipping us the bird, and because we would drive through that parking lot as much as we possibly could.
Did he even go for dinner with us?
What's that, Frank?
You guys even went to dinner with us. In other words, sat at another table, made yourselves very obvious that you were there.
Oh, yeah.
While I was with a girl or something. You know, it's very uncomfortable. But that was your job.
Absolutely. Frank, any of the hole-in-the-wall gang, or especially Tony, if we knew he was meeting or going to a restaurant, we would go to that restaurant. And we would walk inside and let them see us. And they would really, really get upset. The other thing we did was we used all the buildings around the place, and we would hide. We had a famous gas station across the street from Frank's place that me and my partner used to sit up on the roof almost every night and just make notes of who came and who went.
Louis, I got a question, a story I heard. I would like you to tell it. Now, obviously, the guys at the Upper Crust and the lay of it was that they used to have tables outside the Upper Crust where people could sit out there and eat and so forth. And, of course, the Metro and the FBI was always interested in eavesdropping on the conversations that were taking place at these tables. And you guys came up with a rather, I thought it was an ingenious method to get information regarding putting a car there that that had speakers in the grill or something. Could you tell us what came down with that?
Oh, yeah. Our technical unit, our tech guys came up with that. There used to be like two or three tables right in front of the Upper Crust. And of course, the parking lot, you could park directly right in front of the place. So what they came up with was they wired the whole front of the cars. They put microphones in the grills. And we'd have somebody pull up there and park the car and leave it there when we thought people were talking. This went on for a while, and every day we'd have to change it because we knew they would be suspicious of this one car sitting directly in front of the place. So we'd have to change out the cars. And our tech guys really never got anything. Even though people were standing, sitting out there, they weren't talking about business. They were talking about other things. And there was one time they decided to leave the car. And I don't know if it was the first day or the second day, but somebody came and stole the car. And they broke into it and they took the equipment.
Now, was Frank, was that you guys that did that?
No.
This was an independent car thief.
Oh, yeah. Our tech guys wanted to get in touch with Tony and Frank and tell them, you know, what kind of business you're running. You got thieves right in front of you, right in front of the thieves' headquarters.
The only thing we ever took was the FBI's camera and sounding device.
Oh, God. Frank, another thing. Now, I'm going to jump ahead here because we don't have that much time, but I'm going to go. There came a point in 1982 that you had several cases pending, and you were out on bail, and the legal expenses were mounting. Tony wasn't doing everything that, as one of the bosses, that he probably should have been doing according to protocol, as far as paying for lawyer fees and helping out when his troops were in jail for something, as far as taking care of their families. And you had just been convicted of possession of stolen property charge regarding some furniture. And you were in the jail here, and an FBI agent came to see you and told you they had intelligence information from Chicago that the outfit had approved a contract on your life. And I'll skip ahead. You ended up making a deal to become a government witness and went in the witness protection program. And in witness protection, once you're in there, the Marshals, U.S. Marshals Service, is responsible for transporting you safely to your court appearances and so on. And they give you an emergency number to call if there's ever a problem and you feel threatened or there's some kind of problem needs to be addressed right away. You can dial this number and get a hold of them. So you had been in Chicago testifying in court. The Marshals took you from court to the airport and saw you get on the plane. Now, technically, they were, I believe, supposed to wait until the plane actually left. In this case, they apparently didn't. They saw you get on the plane, and they took off. You ended up coming nose-to-nose with a couple of outfit hitmen.
Well, what happened is when I boarded the plane, the plane was ready to pull away, and it backed up, and then they pulled forward, and then they stopped. Well, unbeknownst to me, the marshals left already. See, they parked on the field, and we walked up a ramp to the plane. And then they, when the plane started up and was ready to go, they drove off the field and went to where they were going. Then they told everybody on the plane that this plane was not going to work. So everybody had to get off and make other arrangements. So everybody did get off, and I got off, and I looked for them, and they weren't around. They had given me, I was given an 800 number by the marshal, the inspector. They have an inspector that watches you. To call in case there was ever any problems. It was an 800 number. And I called, and they said that this number was out of service. So I tried again, and they said this number is no longer in use. So I said, well, shit, what am I going to do here? So I went and found another ticket agent, and I went up, come up with my own money, and I had to pay a little bit more, and I jumped on another plane. Well, I got on this other plane, which was going to fly to Dulles, which where I was at. And I, Jesus, all these phones are ringing. So I went to another, I was waiting on the plane, and there wasn't many people on there. And then all of a sudden I noticed two gentlemen whom I knew all my life get on the plane and start walking past me. I put my head down, but I knew who they were, and I was like, oh, shit. So as they walked by me and they sat down, I knew when they were turning their backs because they had carry-ons too. And I reached up on the top, grabbed my carry-on, and got off the plane. Well, one of the individuals was named Paulie Shiro, and I grew up with him. And he looked at me at first like, Jesus, this can't be. You know, I'm sitting there. So, and he was trying to, you know, I mean, it was like, never expected me to be on the plane. So I got off. And then he told the other guy, whose name was Jimmy D'Antonio, James D'Antonio. So I went out and I hid behind a pole. And I noticed right away that they came out and they're looking all around, wondering where I went. Not that they could do much, you know, but they were looking. So then they had to board the plane. And when they did that, then I said, well, I got to call somebody. I'm stuck at this airport over here. So I called the feds and I left a message for this David Kelly to get a hold of me on a payphone where I was at. And he called me right back within 10 minutes and told me to take a cab to Midway Field. And I met him and the other FBI agents over there, and they put me on another plane, and they were really disgusted along with the U.S. attorney because the marshals should have waited, and they didn't.
And they should have told you they had a new phone number.
They should have updated their numbers, and I told them about it. They were quite embarrassed, but, you know, that's, you get a little lax.
Okay, fellas, listen, we only got a couple minutes left, and now you guys obviously, you know, spent a lot of time together back in the day, and since then you've stayed in touch, and you're actually recently got into a little business deal. Louis, could you tell us exactly what you and Frank have going?
Oh, well, what happened was me and my partner had a video production company, and me and Frank always kind of kept together after the secret witness stuff. Frank wrote a book, as you know, and after that, he asked us to help him with some audio tapes. So what we did was we put an audio biography together of Frank's life, and Frank talks about it in his own words. About his entire life with some all them stories and how he escaped many, many incarcerations and many could-be homicides. But it's called Blood Brothers Betrayed.
And I've listened to the part one is out now, and I guess part two is coming soon. And part one is a lot of the Chicago stuff. Part two will be Vegas. And
part,
really,
part two is completely all Vegas, yeah.
To hear Frank tell this stuff in his own words with his accent and emotions or lack of emotions is really quite a thing. Could you tell us where people could listen to a demo of that or buy the recordings if they wanted?
Well, it's all going to hit the market real soon. You can go to dpi-us.com. And you could actually get an actual taste of what the audios are all about in Frank's life.
DPI-US.com.
Yeah.
Okay, and you have they can listen to a demo sample of the recordings?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, our time has just run out. I want to thank both of you guys for being on. Frank, thanks a million. Appreciate it. Nice talking with you again.
All right, Johnny.
And Louis, thanks a lot. I really appreciate that. And it's very interesting stories. And, of course, we could spend, obviously, hours talking about this stuff, and I'd never get bored with it. So thanks again, fellas. I really appreciate it. And you guys take care.
Thank you, Ben.
Louis, I'll see you in Vegas. Goodbye.
Okay, Frank. Bye-bye.
Bye now. So the guests were Frank Collada, former mobster, and Louis D. Tiberius, now retired, Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department detective. Thanks, everybody, for listening. I really appreciate it. And we'll catch you the next time on Las Vegas and the Mob. Good night.